Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 347, Side 2, Axis of Evil, Carlyle's Way. This is being recorded on February 11th of the year 2002. And we're going to plunge right in and begin the second side of the program with discussion that reviews a number of the key connections between the petrodollar milieu and the Bush family. The Carlyle Group, in which the elder George Bush is a major player and in which the younger George Bush sits on the board of directors of a Carlyle subsidiary, Cater Air. I'd like to be eating food on a plane that's catered to by Cater Air. There are a number of other business connections, not only uniting the Bush family and the Bin Laden family, but at an even more important level, it's worth noting that the petrodollar milieu and the oil milieu that cements the Saudi elite to the Bush family, that petrodollar milieu, is far wider than just the Carlyle Group. Key family names, in addition to the Bin Laden family, also the Bin Mahfouz family, and, of course, the Bush family. We're going to review information from an article that was translated for us by a member of the listening audience. This comes from the Swiss German language publication Weltwoche. That is spelled Weltwoche. That in German means World Week. This is from Weltwoche's edition of the 51st week of 2001. It also was reposted on the web on the second week of 2002. The article is entitled Im Wunderland des Hasses, or Malice in Wonderland. The article was authored by Johannes von Dohany, subtitled Terror Trends, Arms Trafficking, and Completely Legal Financial Enterprises, The Connections of Islamic Terrorism Reach into the Power Centers of the West. And of the connections here between the Bin Mahfouz family and the Bin Laden family, Osama bin Laden, the Al-Shifa pharmaceutical factory that, contrary to popular opinion in not only the Islamic world but also among the so-called progressive forces in the United States, in fact, the Al-Shifa factory was apparently involved in making chemical weapons, and it was connected to not only Osama bin Laden but also the Bin Mahfouz family. And note here, the yet another element cementing not only Osama bin Laden and his terror network of al-Qaeda, but also the Bin Mahfouz family, and through that, including through the Carlyle Group, to the Bush family. Note that the Bin Mahfouz family, as discussed here, are prominently involved with the BCCI Corporation, but the BCCI Bank. That was a prominent Pakistani-based bank that was involved in arms trafficking, drug trafficking, the channeling of funds to terrorists. It helped to finance Pakistan's acquisition of nuclear weapons. And last, but certainly not least, it was heavily involved with the Iran-Contra scandal. Turning to Malice in Wonderland by Johannes von Dohany, multi-billionaire Khalid Salim bin Mahfouz was not merely one of the key figures in the international scandal surrounding the Bank of International Credit and Commerce, the bank used by Muslim fundamentalists, secret services, and organized crime. Bin Mahfouz was also a partner to the bin Laden family, among others, in banking and telecommunications sectors, in the oil business, and in the American pharmaceutical firm Hybridon. Both families are business partners of Saudi financier Gayit Faroun, who likewise played an important role in the BCCI scandal, and who in the mid-1980s became embroiled in an abortive operation in the Seychelles Island to buy atomic weapons for Gaddafi. The worldwide bin Laden clan solemnly swears to have broken off any relationship with Osama. Yet much circumstantial evidence suggests that at least indirect contacts continue. Evidence trails also lead to Khalid Salim bin Mahfouz, whose sister, according to CIA statements, is married to the terrorist. Bin Mahfouz is president of the Saudi Sudan Bank, or SSB, in Khartoum. He appointed Saleh Idris as director of SSB. Idris is the official owner of the pharmaceutical Al-Shifa factory, one founded by Osama bin Laden and destroyed in 1998 by American cruise missiles for allegedly being a poison gas factory. Saleh Idris, in turn, is connected to the Tadiman Islamic Bank. This second-largest financial institution in Sudan is part owner of the Al-Shamal Islamic Bank in Khartoum, also founded by Osama bin Laden. On its board of directors sit members of the Faisal Islamic Bank, led by Prince Mohammed Al-Faisal Al-Saud. FIB's parent company is the Bahrain-registered Islamic Investment Company of the Gulf, which is in turn controlled by the Dar al-Mal al-Islami. DMI stands as the most important Saudi finance vehicle for the furthering of international Islamic fundamentalism, or Wahhabism. Just one of many threads, or merely a coincidence? The Saudi International Islamic Relief Organization, funded generously by DMI, resides in London at the same address as the Bin Mahfouz-owned International Development Foundation, or IDF. Into the IIRO allegedly flowed money of the aforementioned Al-Taqwa management of Lugano, Switzerland. It is certain that Osama bin Laden earlier received money from IIRO. Coincidence? Yet the Saudi clans don't just operate in the East. A partner of bin Mahfouz sits on the supervisory board of Carlyle Investment Group. On its board of directors, we find John Sununu, former chief of staff to George H.W. Bush, and James Baker III, Bush's former Secretary of State. President of the board of directors is Frank Carlucci, Reagan's defense secretary. More about some of the business relationships cementing the bin Mahfouzes, the bin Ladens, and the Bushes. Reviewing information that we've talked about and among other programs, For the Record Program 329 and 331. This is from The Mafia, the CIA, and George Bush, authored by Pete Bruton. It's published in hardcover by SPI Books, a subsidiary of Sapolsky Publishers. It's copyright 1992 by Pete Bruton. Now, what we're going to be talking about here is the relationship between Arbusto Energy, one of its initial investors, James R. Bath, and the bin Laden and bin Mahfouz families. For it is the aforementioned James R. Bath, who is the Texas business representative for both, in fact, the North American business representative for both families. It was at the Air National Guard that Bath met George W. Bush. They became good friends, but according to Bush, never did any business together. However, records filed in a lawsuit in Houston involving Bath contradict the president's son. They show Bath was an investor in a Bush oil and gas enterprise. That, of course, was Arbusto Energy. We've looked at that connection in numerous broadcasts in the past. Skipping down. Several months after Bath and Taylor started Jim Bath & Associates, Bath got a huge break. He was named as a trustee for Sheikh Salem bin Laden of Saudi Arabia, a member of the family that owns the largest construction company in the Middle East. Bath's job was to handle all of bin Laden's North American investments and operations. That sentence one more time. Bath's job was to handle all of bin Laden's North American investments and operations. Bin Laden's father, Mohammed bin Laden, was a patient of Adnan Khashoggi's physician father and got Khashoggi involved in his first deal as a middleman. Adnan Khashoggi, by the way, the Saudi-based weapons dealer, was a key player in the Iran-Contra scandal. According to associates of James R. Bath, he was allegedly recruited into the CIA by the elder George Bush. And bear in mind that he was a primary investor in George W.'s first oil company, Arbusto Energy. People who knew him at the time said that he didn't have much money of his own, so in all likelihood, the money that he invested in Arbusto came from his Saudi clients, including quite possibly the bin Laden family. Continuing. Speaking of the Mohammed bin Laden Khashoggi connection, this was a truck sale that Khashoggi engineered in the 1950s, just after he returned from college in America. Khashoggi sent the $25,000 commission to bin Laden, who returned it to Khashoggi. According to federal law enforcement sources, bin Laden also did business with Salim Saab, the Lebanese who was a partner with Cayman attorney Ian Paget Brown in Sarah Limited, which borrowed money from mainland. These sources said Saab listed on his resume a contract he had with bin Laden that was secured by a November 1984 letter of credit for $86,000. Several months after Bath was named as a trustee for bin Laden, He became the trustee for Sheikh Abdullah Barum, who owned a large Saudi Arabian cement and steel company. Then, sometime later, he began working for Sheikh Khalid bin Mahfouz, the former chief executive officer of his family's national commercial bank, Saudi Arabia's biggest and most closely related to the royal family bank. Sheikh Khalid remained in his position at NCB until 1 week after he and his London-based associate, Haroon Kalloon, were indicted in New York in 1992 on charges that they had schemed to defraud depositors, regulators, and auditors of the insolvent BCCI. And bearing in mind the Bin Laden, Bush, Bin Mahfouz connections, which go through Carlyle and through Arbusto Energy and James R. Bath, among other things, we're going to jump now to the immediate past. This specifically is from the Wall Street Journal of Wednesday, February 6th of 2002. This is an article by James M. Dorsey. It's headlined, Saudi Arabia is Monitoring Key Bank Accounts, subtitled at U.S. Request, Kingdom Investigates Businesses in Bid to Cut Terror Funds. And one of the businesses, one of the business nexuses, so to speak, being investigated here is that of the Bin Mahfouz family. Speaking of these accounts, skipping down, the Bin Mahfouz family, separate members of which own National Commercial Bank, Saudi Arabia's largest bank, and the Saudi Economic Development Company, and the Abdulajif Jamil group of companies, are among 150 accounts being monitored by SAMA, the Saudis and Riyadh-based U.S. officials said. Excuse me, let me read that sentence again. The Bin Mahfouz family, separate members of which own National Commercial Bank, Saudi Arabia's largest bank, and the Saudi Economic Development Company, and the Abdulajif Jamil group of companies, are among 150 accounts being monitored by SAMA, the Saudis, and Riyadh-based officials said. The U.S. officials said the names of the accounts were presented by the U.S. to Saudi Arabia since the September 11th terrorist attacks in the U.S. They said four Saudi charities and eight businesses were also among 140 worldwide names given to Saudi Arabia last month, skipping down. Among the Bin Mahfouz family, Abdul Rahman Bin Mahfouz was a board member of Muwafaq, a defunct Jersey-registered charity headed by Yassin Al-Qadi. We talked about that, by the way, in For the Record 330. Mr. Qadi has challenged the freezing of his assets in a British court, as well as at the European Court of Justice. Speaking in a telephone interview, Mr. Mahfouz denied that SAMA was monitoring accounts related to his family or businesses. Quote, I don't believe that our names are among the 150. None of our accounts are under SAMA's supervision, unquote. He said authorities in Britain had, however, recently frozen accounts of the International Development Fund, a British-based charity operated by several of his uncles. That, by the way, was discussed in the Weltfunk article that we looked at earlier. We're going to review yet another Bush-Saudi Arabia business connection, this one apparently just in the blossoming stage. We looked at this last week. We're going to review it very quickly right now. This is from Newsweek's issue of February 4th of 2002. This was researched for us by a member of the listening audience, and this concerns Neil Bush, George Bush's brother's presence at a Jeddah, Saudi Arabia conference at which wealthy Saudi investors, including the Bin Laden family, who helped sponsor the conference, were kicking around, among other things, how September 11th was going to affect their American investments. This article is authored by Michael Isikoff. It's in the Periscope column. It's titled, Neil Bush's Saudi Business Connection. It reads in part, what was Neil Bush doing in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia last week? Officially, the president's youngest brother was a keynote speaker at an international business forum. Among the main backers of the event, the Saudi Bin Laden Construction Group and Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, the tycoon whose $10 million offer to help the victims of the World Trade Center attacks was rejected last fall by New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. With an audience filled with Saudi royals, Bush talked about the role of public opinion in shaping U.S. Mideast policy. But Bush's main purpose wasn't public relations advice. Newsweek has learned the presidential sibling also had another agenda, recruiting Middle East investors for an educational software firm that industry sources say may benefit enormously from the new $26.5 billion education bill signed by President George W. Bush. Neil Bush's Austin-based firm called Ignite has raised about $18 million since last year, mostly from foreign investors in Japan, Taiwan, and the Middle East, said Ignite executive Kenneth Leonard, skipping down. By the way, note that Prince Al-Waleed is an associate of, among others, Yosef Nada of Nada Management, whom we looked at in 342 and 343, among other programs. I would also note that Prince Al-Waleed is a business partner with Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, a former member of Licio Gelli's P2 Lodge. And for those who think that there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans, skipping down again in this article, Bush wasn't the only high-profile figure on the Saudi circuit. Also speaking at the Jeddah Forum, Bill Clinton, who was paid $300,000, skipping down. When Clinton learned bin Laden family members who have disowned their terrorist brother were coming to a dinner in his honor, Clinton had them disinvited, unquote, said a Clinton spokeswoman. He also avoided Prince Al-Waleed, quote, like the plague, unquote, said the same source. Note, Clinton also, at that very same Jeddah conference, had some comments that very much upset his Saudi host. Specifically, he not only faulted Saudi Arabia for allowing fundamentalist Islamic schools in Saudi Arabia to promote Wahhabism and violence, he also faulted the Palestinians for walking out of the Camp David peace talks in the summer of 2000. Recall that Ehud Barak, who had staked his administration's survival on a successful peace negotiation, had offered the Palestinians 95% of the occupied territories, official recognition of a Palestinian state, and the opportunity to share Jerusalem as a capital. That was rejected. Yasser Arafat walked out of the negotiations. This was the same day that oil man Dick Cheney was named by oil man George Bush as his vice presidential candidate. Reviewing information about the Jeddah conference, this from the Financial Times of Monday, January 21st of the year 2002, an article by Rula Khalaf in Jeddah headlined, Jeddah businessmen frustrated by tense relations with the U.S., skipping down. The message at the conference was not comforting. Mr. Clinton said efforts must be made on both sides and that Saudis and the Islamic world should address issues such as a, quote, rhetoric of hatred in schools, unquote, and agree that suicide attacks against Israeli civilians were unacceptable and harmed the Palestinian cause. His comments were politely praised by many as a useful form of dialogue, but some participants complained about his remarks on Palestinian violence. Quote, we know we have issues to address, but he blames violence in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict on the Palestinians again without talking about Israeli violence. That's the heart of the problem of terrorism, and the U.S. won't address it, unquote, said a participant. Now, in that regard, we're going to take a look, first of all, at an item that we talked about in For the Record 340. This is from The Kingdom, authored by Robert Lacey, published in hardcover by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich. It's copyrighted 1981, ISBN number 0-15-147260-2. And this is a discussion of something that's actually fairly well known in certain circles, and that is that the fact that the PLO is bankrolled and always has been by Saudi Arabia. In the Kingdom, Robert Lacey writes, Saudi Arabia is Yasser Arafat's principal financial supporter. Increasing Saudi subsidies to the PLO since 1973 have given the organization currency reserves estimated at over $1 billion, larger than those of many third world countries, and most inhabitants of the kingdom are proud that Saudi oil revenues should be supporting the cause of their Palestinian brothers. But the idea that Saudi Arabia should lend such massive support to men usually seen in the West as terrorists is deeply offensive to many people outside the Muslim world. This support to the Palestinians flatly contradicts in their eyes the word moderate, unquote, so often used by the kingdom's Western friends to describe Saudi international strategy, and this contradiction has lain at the heart of the foreign policy pursued since 1975 by King Khalid, Crown Prince Fahad and their brothers. I would note that not only in Saudi Arabia, but elsewhere in the Middle East and in other Muslim countries, as well as in reactionary circles in the West, the problems of September 11th and the problems of the Muslim countries in general are being blamed on Israel. Not only are those countries not run by Jews, let alone Israelis, but Israel doesn't have any oil, and there are exactly 5 million of them. There are 1.2 billion Muslims. One of the reasons, and in candid moments, the Saudi elite or members of them have been quite candid in saying that they have no use for the Palestinians, whom they consider, quote, communists, unquote. But basically, the Israeli-Palestinian question serves to distract from the very real economic problems, not only in Saudi Arabia, but in many other countries, which Middle Eastern and Muslim, which to a large extent are caused by the fact that the elites in those countries benefit from large cartels, basically, government-sponsored monopolies, which are insured by the government and which are protected by very, very rigorous tariffs that are basically protective tariffs. In turn, those elites, to a large extent, take the money from those countries and invest it abroad, such as the petrodollar connection that we've been looking at, and they do not invest it in domestic industry, which would promote economic growth. This, by the way, is beginning to become a subject of considerable frustration in Saudi Arabia, and that frustration in turn is feeding Islamic fundamentalism. Financial Times of Monday, January 28th of 2002, had another article by Rula Khalaf. This one headlined, Saudi Deficit Mystery Symbolizes Frustration. Skipping down. The Saudi budget deficit has become a symbol of the frustration with a slow pace of economic reforms and the absence of transparency and accountability in government. The debate over economic change has also been driven by post-September 11th questions that failure to reform the Saudi economy and create sufficient jobs for a young population was contributing to radicalization of Saudi youth, as indeed it apparently has been. We're going to, first of all, review an element. We're going to be taking a look now at a very cynical, we're going to be taking a look at it greater length, at a very cynical and Machiavellian manipulation of the Israeli right, which has a fascist heritage itself, by the Republican right. And I believe in this regard they were not only working to exacerbate the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but also, in particular, to destabilize Bill Clinton and ultimately to prevent Bill Clinton from successfully brokering a Mideast peace agreement, which would have given Al Gore a major campaign tool. This also, by the way, deep-sixed Ehud Barak, who was then voted out of office in favor of Ariel Sharon. Returning to the book Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeviere, speaking of the attacks on the Al-Shifa factory, controlled in part by allies of the Bin Mahfouz family, in addition, the Muslim Brotherhood condemned the American attacks in a press statement declaring that they were, quote, a diversion from the scandals confronting the President of the United States, unquote, referring to the President's sordid affair with a White House intern, Monica Lewinsky. We're also going to take a look at one of the elements in the frustration, not only of the peace process and peace forces in Israel, but also of Bill Clinton. One of the things that the Republicans did was to pass a bill, that was vetoed by Clinton and opposed by Yitzhak Rabin that would have moved the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. This was viewed by Clinton and by the late Yitzhak Rabin as provocative. Turning once again to Dollars for Terror, indeed, constitutionally, the president can suspend the application of a law approved by Congress if he judges it contrary to the higher interests of the country, as was the case for the Dole law that proposed to transfer the embassy of the United States to Jerusalem. And that law, which was that bill sponsored by Bob Dole, passed by the Republican-controlled Congress, was vetoed by Bill Clinton. Now, again, Yitzhak Rabin opposed that bill. He was assassinated in 1995. And what I'm going to do is to briefly delineate an ongoing dalliance between the Republican right And between the Republican Party, the Israeli right, which itself has a fascist heritage, as we've seen in miscellaneous archive shows M30 and M58, and which in turn, I believe, led to the destabilization of the Camp David Accords. Now, in 1998, Benjamin Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu, whose father, Benzion Netanyahu, was the personal secretary to, pallbearer for, and aide to Vladimir Yabotinsky, the head of the Beitar, the primary element in the fascist part of the Zionist movement. In 1998, a representative of the Likud party represented the Likud party at the National Conference of the Alleanza Nazionale, the Italian fascist party. Also in 1998, the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke, and in For the Record Program 139, we took a look at allegations from the book Gideon Spies by Max Hastings that a right-wing element of Israeli intelligence was manipulating the Monica Lewinsky scandal for its own benefit. Also, in 1998, Newt Gingrich traveled to Israel and officially opposed U.S. policy on the peace process in an address to the Knesset. Now, this was at the same time as the Likud party was sending a representative along with the Republican Party of the United States to the National Conference of the Alleanza Nazionale. Now, in the spring of 2000, Ariel Sharon met with Silvio Berlusconi, again of the P2 Lodge, a partner of Prince al-Walid, and a person in whose coalition government Gianfranco Fini and Alleanza Nazionale, the heirs to Mussolini's fascist party, participated as a coalition partner. That was in the spring of 2000, and we looked at that in For the Record program number 252. Now, in the summer of 2000, Yasser Arafat walks out of the Camp David peace accords on the same day that George Bush, the oil man, names Dick Cheney, the oil man, as his vice presidential candidate. This not only denies Al Gore the campaign issue of the Democrats having successfully brokered a peace negotiation, a long-awaited peace process, but this also led to the defeat of Ehud Barak and his succession by Ariel Sharon of the Likud party. The last substantive item that we're going to review in this broadcast is an item that we've looked at before. It's worth bearing in mind who the negotiating team for the PLO was. And we've talked about the scotching of the peace negotiations in For the Record 334, 337, and 340. We're going to take a look now at the book, The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by former government investigator John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, published in hardcover by the St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. Of the composition of the negotiating team for the PLO, we read, "The CIA secretly brought several moderate Palestinians to the United States for intensive briefing. This group, codenamed Baker's Dozen, included most of the official Palestinian negotiating team with Israel. Quote, Hanan Ashrawi, Hana Senora, Saib Erekat, Sari Nusebeh, and other lower-ranking Palestinians were summoned to Langley for a three-day conference on integrating their politics with the U.S. So the Palestinian negotiating team, protégés of James Baker, one of the people who was watching the September 11th proceedings along with members of the Bin Laden family at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Washington, D.C. on September 11th. All of which, I guess, goes to prove nothing so much as what Dr. Johnson observed centuries ago when he said that, quote, "It can be truly said that treason doth never succeed, for when it doth succeed, none dare call it treason." Well, hardly anybody. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 347, Axis of Evil, Carlyle's Way. This is being recorded on February 11th of the year 2002. There will be a description in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Links in that description to two websites run by sister station WFMU. And all of the For the Record programs you heard alluded to are available for download on one of those WFMU websites. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.